This is The Takeaway for Monday, June 5th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The soft terror of small-scale ISIS and a pre-election strategy shift in Britain for the jihadist movement. Three men and a van drove into pedestrians on the London Bridge over the weekend, an attack as simple as a drunk driving incident in Times Square a little over 2 weeks earlier. But with the signature of jihadist terror, the entire city of London was suddenly on full alert as the van then continued onto the nearby Borough Market night spot where the men began stabbing civilians. Less than 10 minutes later, police put an end to the attack, shooting roughly 50 bullets at the attackers, killing all three and only hitting one civilian who is said to be in stable condition. At least seven people were killed by the men, 48 hospitalized. Of those, 48, 21 are said to be in critical condition. Yesterday, ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack. Small scale, yes. Large impact, yes. And coming less than 2 weeks after the Manchester bombing that killed 22 people, one of three terrorist attacks to hit England in the last 3 months, the nation is conditioned, braced, if you will, for more. Londoners, including those who survived the attack, told the media they were defiant and in solidarity. Muslim London Mayor Sadiq Khan said he was appalled and furious at the cowardly attack, urging residents to remain calm and warning that a heightened police presence throughout Metro London is to be rolled out in the coming days. Prime Minister Theresa May, who is facing a general election on Thursday, offered a series of responses to counter the attacks. Quilliam International is a counter-extremist organization headquartered in the United Kingdom, which has advised the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. National Counterterrorism Center. Usama Hassan is head of Islamic Studies with Quilliam International. He says, from London, we are looking at a shift in ISIS strategy that allows it to take credit for attacks while loosening its connection to the attackers.
This is what ISIS and Al-Qaeda have been inciting for many years, to say you don't have to make sophisticated bombs. You can attack people with a car, a van, a truck, and a kitchen knife. And that's precisely what we've seen in this attack. And it's not just the soft target element. There is also the demonization of Western lifestyle, which is very important. So for the extremists, they absolutely hate, you know, Western lifestyle because they regard them as un-Islamic. So things like music, alcohol, you know, being out at a bar or a nightclub, a restaurant on a Saturday evening, this is all anathema to these fanatical fundamentalist terrorists. And we mustn't forget that. There's a reason why a pop concert was targeted in Manchester. It is because the extremists believe that is all pure evil, music, alcohol, having fun, unveiled women, etc.
That's something we've known since the Islamic Revolution in Iran. I think what's important to underscore is that on the websites of ISIL and the websites of radicalism that are deliberately targeting the people who might carry out these attacks, it is this hitting the lifestyle over and over and over again. This isn't sort of war with Bush and Trump and Theresa May. This is much more the lifestyle that you're hearing in the language online.
Yes. And there is also a strategic shift, coming back to the earlier question, because after 9/11, a lot of the language was aimed at targeting Western troops, for example, police, aspects of the state. And over the last 3 or 4 years, since the so-called caliphate was declared in Syria and Iraq, the emphasis was come over to the caliphate, come and join the war, the jihad here. Now that that's failing, it's crumbling. That is the strategic shift to say, well, take the war back to your own countries. But they know that individuals are very unlikely to be able to attack heavily fortified government installations like the military or police, etc. So the next strategic shift is precisely innocent civilians. But this is justified in their minds by saying these are Western taxpayers who are supporting government actions abroad and all this kind of twisted logic which the terrorists use. Anything, any argument that justifies their war on non-believers, if you like, and their dehumanization and murder of non-believers, that is acceptable for them. And we have to be very careful about giving in to such hate speech and divisive rhetoric. The wider issue about marginalizing these extremist voices, it's a difficult task. It's been done before, though. If you think about issues about racism, which we've had in the US and in Britain as well, until recently, you know, a few decades ago, racism was the norm, if you like, in British society, as was homophobia and other issues. But civic society came together from all different places to make racism, anti-Semitism, homophobia, etc., unacceptable. The wider issue that you mention about marginalizing these extremist voices, as you said, the extremists have been hiding in plain sight, and there are too many sympathizers, too many hate preachers, people who are anti-Western, who complain about Islamophobia but are actually very Westerphobic, for example. And those kinds of attitudes have to also be marginalized and made unacceptable. And we have to accept that the Islamic tradition has deep resources about statecraft, about building modern nation states, about citizenship, equal citizenship, irrespective of religion. And that's really the only way forward in the modern world, because every society needs a social contract. Now, the terrorist groups do not accept the modern world. They do not accept a modern nation states or shared values, etc. And we have to defeat that argument intellectually and religiously from the Islamic tradition.
Not to celebrate or, I guess, focus on inappropriately emotionalism, Osama Hassan, you're there in London. I mean, it's got to feel like everyone's next.
Well, there's certainly a very somber mood. I was at the scene of the attacks this morning, and it's very dignified, it's very somber, a very kind of sad mood, but also quite defiant. People are returning to work. They're going about their daily business. There's a lot of anger and resentment, which I think is very restrained. People do want to see action. I think Prime Minister Theresa May resonated yesterday when she said enough is enough, things have to change. We can't carry on just saying just go back to normal, because clearly normal means more terrorist attacks, sadly. So we do have to change things. And I think people want to see the extremists confronted head on by authorities, but also by Muslim communities. I sense the shock within Muslim communities that our religion has been smeared again by this kind of action, but also a sense that we are going to take the steps necessary. So just as white working class communities have to take ownership of the far right neo-Nazi extremist and terrorist threat across the West, Muslim communities do have to take ownership of this fringe problem of terrorism coming from ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
Quite a historic national debate to be going on in the UK, that's for sure. Osama Hassan is head of Islamic studies with Quilliam. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
There was a strident tone emerging from the White House as President Trump used Twitter to try and get out ahead of the news cycle reacting to the London attacks. Among his statements, "We must stop being politically correct and get down to the business of security for our people. If we don't get smart, it will only get worse. At least 7 dead and 48 wounded in terror attack, and Mayor of London says there is, quote, no reason to be alarmed, end quote." Those words were widely said to have unfairly characterized what the London mayor was saying to his own citizens. Another Trump statement: "Do you notice we are not having a gun debate right now? That's because they used knives and a truck." And this provocative statement today aimed at the U.S. judiciary: "We need to be smart, vigilant, and tough. We need the courts to give us back our rights. We need the travel ban as an extra level of safety." The president just returned from a Middle East trip, and it seems that some of his views on fighting terrorism found sympathetic ears, or at least agreement, in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia and the UAE, along with Bahrain and others, have cut diplomatic ties with Qatar, the home of a major U.S. military installation. The reason? Qatar's alleged support for Iranian-inspired terrorism throughout the Middle East. Mark Lynch is director of the Project on Middle East Political Science at the George Washington University and a non-resident fellow at the Carnegie Endowment Middle East Center. He says this is a huge development with some very complicated details.
Qatar has had a long rivalry with Saudi Arabia. They've been kind of at each other's throats for many years over the idea that Saudi Arabia should be the hegemon of the Gulf. And so since the mid-90s, they've been bickering and going at each other over the leadership of the region and leadership of the Gulf Cooperation Council. And since the Arab Spring in 2011, this has gotten even more intense and there have just been real controversies over the role of Islamist movements and the value of democracy, and then just basic, you know, struggles for power and influence within the Arab world. So what we've seen this week is not really new. It's just an escalation of a feud that's been going on for quite some time.
But if there is something new, is it fair to say, and dispute this if you like, that either Saudi Arabia or Qatar has taken a stake, put a flag in the sand, so to speak, of a larger Sunni-Shia conflict that would basically set Iran against everyone else in the Gulf region, Qatar included, and you know, this inflames a very deep sectarian conflict.
You know, we like to think in terms of there being a Sunni-Shia conflict, which defines the region, and that certainly is important. But what we see between Saudi Arabia and Qatar is actually an intra-Sunni battle, where you basically have two Sunni powers with different visions for what the region should look like, who are fighting it out. And Iran is sitting there, and they're an important part of this, but it's not the primary focus. But one thing which is really clear, though, I think to most of us, is that when President Trump went to Saudi Arabia, he really clearly and powerfully embraced the Saudi and United Arab Emirates' vision of the Middle East. He basically endorsed their claim to leadership. And it seems that that's what emboldened the Saudis and the Emiratis to go after Qatar at this moment. The idea that they had Trump's backing, and this allowed them to finally kind of settle the score with their rival.
The U.S. Interest and involvement in Yemen will escalate, yes?
The fallout in Yemen is hard to say. Qatar was never a major player in Yemen in the same way that the Saudis and the Emiratis were. Back in about a year and a half ago, it was a big deal when Qatar finally came on board the Saudi-led campaign. That was seen as a major sign of improving Gulf relations. But if their 1,000 or so soldiers pull out, that's not going to make a huge difference inside of Yemen. It'll make a bigger difference in some of the other fronts around the region.
The Secretary of State says it's not going to affect anything regarding terrorism, but there are huge investments in Qatar from educational institutions in the United States. There's this education city in Qatar. Is all of that in question now?
I think it's premature for that. I mean, usually these kinds of intra-Gulf squabbles, you know, they flare up and then they die down again. They've escalated farther this time than they have in the past. But at this point, I think it's premature to look at that stuff. But you know, if you look at it, though, Qatar is always been an interesting ally for the United States because it has, you know, this major military base, an American military base there, which is absolutely central for American operations around the region.
Right.
But at the same time, it maintains good relationships with groups like Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood, and has played a pretty, in my view, pretty destructive role in Syria. On the other hand, in some ways, I think the United States was closer to Qatar's point of view in areas like Tunisia and Egypt. And so, you know, the U.S. right now under Trump has gotten really close to the Saudi and UAE view of things, but it hasn't always been that way. But Qatar has always maintained this more independent position within the region's politics. And I think the real question is whether they'll be able to sustain that. The reports are already that they've asked Hamas leadership to leave the country, which seems to be a concession to the pressure that they're under. But we don't know what the next steps are likely to be.
Mark Lynch is director of the Project on Middle East Political Science at the George Washington University and a non-resident fellow at the Carnegie Endowment Middle East Center. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
It is becoming increasingly clear from weeks of reporting and investigations, and yes, it's fair to say leaks from those investigations, in some cases from leakers with an axe to grind with the White House, that the Trump effort to get Obama-era and European Union sanctions imposed on Russia after the war in Ukraine began, and the Trump team's sympathy with Vladimir Putin was active very early in the campaign, in the transition. And as new reporting reveals, as soon as President Trump took office, Trump and his administration reportedly moved quickly to try to lift economic sanctions and return diplomatic compounds to Russia in an effort to extend goodwill and normalize relations with the Kremlin. As quickly, former officials scrambled to lobby lawmakers to block the moves by making the sanctions more immune to being lifted by executive order. One of those former officials was Tom Malinowski, a former Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor under the Obama administration, who noticed an aggressive Trump anti-sanctions initiative well before he officially left office.
During the transition, when I was still, of course, a member of the Obama administration, we were very, very focused on ensuring that any evidence in the possession of the U.S. government leading to suggesting that there was this kind of collusion, that that evidence be properly preserved, that it be shared in appropriate ways with cleared members of the United States Congress who could continue an investigation after the presidential transition. And then immediately after the transition, I had left the administration, but I picked up alarm bells from career folks who were still in the government that, in fact, the Trump team may have been moving to reach some sort of deal with the Russians that would include lifting the sanctions. I and others alerted members of Congress to this possibility and urged the Congress to, as a safeguard, enact into law the sanctions that President Obama imposed by executive order. And in fact, Senator Cardin of Maryland, Senator McCain, Senator Graham, Senator Rubio, a bipartisan group of senators did introduce legislation to do that, and that legislation is still pending.
People could debate policy, but it's fair to say that you were just really alarmed by the idea that this reversal should happen so quickly.
The sanctions were put into place for a very good and important reason. Russia invaded a neighboring country because it was upset about really the progress of democracy in that country. It seized territory, the peninsula of Crimea, the first since World War II effort by great power in Europe to try to seize territory by force. We in the Obama administration, joined by a absolutely rock-solid bipartisan consensus, Republicans and Democrats, believed that this was a serious threat to the post-World War II international system and to ultimately the security of the United States. The sanctions were imposed with a clear condition that Russia meet its obligations under agreements that it signed to get out of Ukraine before the sanctions would be lifted. What we were afraid of is that they would lift the sanctions in effect for nothing. Russia would not meet its side of the bargain, and we would simply make that concession. So, fortunately, it did not happen. I think it did not happen primarily because Congress did raise very serious alarms, because General Flynn was fired, and because of a lot of really excellent investigative journalism that has increased the heat on the administration and I think made it politically hard for them to make concessions to Russia that would add fuel to the fire of these suspicions that there was a pre-election deal. But it's still something we have to be vigilant about.
Is it generally the case that what looks to be a huge international power struggle would go on in the middle of the transition, as opposed to everything else that's supposed to be happening, hiring people, learning about who goes to what office, that sort of thing?
It's really, really bizarre. First of all, when I first learned that Trump transition officials were talking to the Russians, my reaction was, oh, you know, that's normal. And I assume we know that because they made those contacts through our State Department switchboard. So that's normally how it works. A transition team will begin to make contacts with countries around the world, and they'll do it by putting their phone calls through the State Department Operations Center or the White House Situation Room. And it's all done in a very open and transparent way, and they're not making foreign policy yet. They're just getting to know their future international counterparts. What we found hard to believe and quite shocking was that they were actually not going through the established communications channels of the U.S. government, that they were doing this on their own. And at that point, we had no idea what the content of these conversations were, but certainly it gave rise to a lot of suspicions. And why were they in such a rush is another question. They were going to take over the reins in just a few weeks. They would have plenty of time to formulate policy, hopefully in consultation with career professionals in the intelligence community, in the State Department, and in our military. And yet there seemed to be this rush to do something mysterious. And, you know, certainly it intensifies my suspicions that this was more than just ordinary policymaking, that it was in fact the culmination of what might well have been collusion during the campaign. And the truth is absolutely discoverable here, and I think will in time be known to the American people. Whether we're going to know through some hearing or through some other means, I don't know, but I'm confident of this.
Tom Malinowski is a former Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor under the Obama administration. Mr. Malinowski, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Over the course of the last 3 years, many dozens of women have publicly accused Bill Cosby of sexual misconduct. But the allegations have been around for as many decades. The former American icon and voice of morality is now a symbol of the exact opposite. But only one of those dozens of stories reaches the legal threshold to possibly send Cosby to jail. That's the case of Andrea Constand, who alleges that Cosby drugged and sexually assaulted her at his home outside of Philadelphia in 2004. And her case against Cosby begins today. We spoke with Annette John Hall, WHYY Keystone Crossroads reporter and host of the podcast Cosby Unraveled.
Where we stand is the culmination of nearly 12 years of a case against Cosby brought by one person, Andrea Constand, who was an employee of the Temple women's basketball team, and way back in 2004 brought a case against Cosby alleging that he assaulted her. And it has taken this long with so many twists and turns. This case has had political ramifications. It is fraught with, you know, racial and gender bias. And finally today, we'll see the start of this in a courtroom outside of Philadelphia. These allegations have been lingering in the background for almost 50 years.
Wow.
And he was, this case with Andrea Constand got under the gun like just 2 months before the statute of limitations was up on it, which is why she is the only alleged victim whose case has been heard. But when you consider that these allegations have been out there for all these years, if true, it is very, very troubling indeed.
In those 50 years, what changed? Did America change? Did the legal system change? Did the victims change?
I think, you know, what's changed really is that as the years have gone on, you know, like, for instance, in the 70s, there was a big party mentality. These situations weren't taken as seriously as they have been now. I think in this particular case, what changed was that women started to come forward. There is power in numbers. And when women come forward like that, it's empowering. And I think that's what happened. We read so many accounts of women who talked very specifically about what they say Cosby did to them. And when asked why they never came forward, they said no one would believe them. Cosby is like a global entertainer with power and cachet. And these women were trying to, in many cases, get their careers started in the entertainment industry. They looked at Cosby as a mentor and never thought that they could get any audience with anybody to hear their claims. But once people started to come forward, then women felt empowered and emboldened to support each other.
Your podcast, Cosby Unraveled, you're dealing with all of the hot button issues at once. And I'm wondering if that contributes to the argument that the Cosby lawyers will use, that it's impossible to assemble a jury.
Well, certainly they're going to argue that, and it really is unavoidable, right? But of course, that's to be expected. But, you know, facts are facts. And when Cosby was deposed in 2006, his own words stated what he liked to do to women, which was give them drugs, give them Quaaludes, I think, was in the deposition, and for the purpose to have sex with them. So no matter what you hear and no matter what swirls around you, the facts are right there in the deposition in Cosby's own words.
Annette John Hall, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Annette John Hall is WHYY Keystone Crossroads reporter and host of the podcast Cosby Unraveled.
The whole war on obesity is a war on people.
The question is, do we have an environment that supports responsible decision or undermines responsible decisions?
So most food pantries in the U.S., it's still Cheerios, spaghetti, canned green beans, frozen starches, anything like that.
We have portion sizes that are extremely large, pricing incentives to buy unhealthy food, tremendously powerful marketing forces are occurring, and that just begins the list.
Losing weight is more powerful than really any drug we've ever developed.
I want to be taken seriously, no matter what my weight.
It's something public health experts have been telling us for more than a decade. More than 2 in 3 American adults are overweight. 1 in 3 are obese. For children, the numbers have actually turned a corner and begun to improve, but still, 1 in 6 children are obese. And when they grow up, they have some tough stories to tell.
Hi, this is Todd calling from Kingman, Arizona. When I was obese, I was told I was useless. I was told I had 2 speeds, slow and stop. And, well, it kind of ruined my life.
This is Heather in Arlington, Virginia. And I've never been overweight, but I have 3 brothers, and they all weigh around 400 pounds. I've seen them struggle with weight since elementary school and the emotional impact it's had on them. It's made me stand up to those who make fat comments. I go out of my way to make sure everyone around me feels as comfortable as possible in their own skin.
We're hearing lots of those stories of humiliation and isolation from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Keep the calls coming. We'll be exploring this major public health issue all week, collaborating with veteran healthcare and medical science reporter Mary Harris, host of the podcast Only Human. We begin with Dr. Sam Klein, director of the Center for Human Nutrition at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, who told Mary that we need to take this epidemic far more seriously than we currently are.
So obesity is a complex disease. It's a multifactorial disease that affects every aspect of our society and is a greater public health challenge than anything else, in any virus, any other disease, and even terrorism.
And Dr. Klein says with a host of contributing factors.
Genetics, hormones, the environment they live in, the school system, the job that they have, you know, the availability of food, the attractiveness of food, the taste of food, the commercials for food, our lifestyle, sedentary lifestyle. There's multiple factors that bombard them 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, that make it very difficult to change lifestyle habits to consume less calories and lose weight.
Dr. Klein says that consumers aren't getting much help from the wider culture. This week, we'll look at how high-calorie food gets marketed to kids, the legal fight against sugar and sugary beverages, and the counter-argument that people should be free to consume whatever they want. Hunger and obesity are siblings. One literally drives the other. As we mentioned, Mary Harris, health reporter for WNYC and co-host of the Only Human podcast, is presenting our series. And Mary's conversation with Dr. Sam Klein reminds us about the scientific reality and unscientific myths about obesity.
I think the biggest myth that people might have is that there's something wrong with their metabolism, that they just look at food and gain weight. And so there's something different about them than other people. And it gets even more complicated than that. It's not just what makes some people obese and some people not obese, but some people who are obese have all the metabolic problems you'd think of associated with obesity, like abnormal blood lipids, blood pressure, abnormal blood sugar, even type 2 diabetes, whereas some people who are obese are protected from those adverse metabolic effects. We're not sure why some people who have excess body weight do not get the metabolic problems associated with obesity, as do most people who are obese.
You're painting such a complicated picture.
It is. Obesity should be considered a heterogeneous disease that is not just the same for every person. The mechanisms for why someone becomes obese is the same for everyone. You eat more calories than you burn up over a long period of time. But the reasons why some people do that and others don't is different for every single person. And then once you gain that weight, some people have metabolic abnormalities and some don't. Some get complications with their joints, some don't. Some get cancer from obesity, some don't. Why certain people are predisposed to certain diseases associated with obesity and others don't get those diseases, and in fact are even protected from getting those diseases, is a mystery and is an area of active research.
Yeah, you're actually studying people like this, right?
Exactly. We're taking people who are metabolically normal and obese and people who are metabolically abnormal and obese. So there are healthy obese people and unhealthy obese people. We're trying to understand why the healthy obese people are that way. Why don't they get the side effects of obesity? And why do the others get the side effects? We're also trying to understand is why is weight loss so therapeutic? Losing weight is more powerful than really any drug we've ever developed. So if you can get people to lose weight for obesity-related abnormalities, it's the most therapeutic option that you have.
You've been pretty outspoken about advocacy for obesity and the fact that we need more advocacy on behalf of obesity. You know, I wonder when you've gone to Capitol Hill to advocate, what has the response been?
Yeah, we did this a few years ago when I was president of one of the obesity societies, and the response we uniformly got is that we just need to educate people. We just need to tell people to eat less food. We don't need to put a lot of money into programs or research or policies. We just need to let people know that it's bad to eat too much. And we know that doesn't work. Education is not enough. We really have to go beyond education, understand the metabolic and hormonal underpinnings of obesity, understand why obesity causes disease, and then we can come up with ways to prevent obesity as well as prevent the link between obesity and disease.
Dr. Sam Klein, director for the Center for Human Nutrition at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. Amanda Horahan, as we heard, is overweight and has had a really hard time finding doctors who she says understand her and her issues. All they see, she says, is her weight. So if medical professionals truly want to help overweight Americans, Amanda told Mary Harris, they need a different approach altogether based on her experience.
I was very active as a child. I played a lot of softball, and I didn't think I was that fat. And then I think right when I hit puberty is when I started feeling like I was not like the rest of all the other girls. All my other friends were much thinner, and I had bigger thighs, and I thought that maybe there was something wrong with me.
How common was it for doctors to comment on how you looked?
Well, there was one instance, and it is very common, and I know it's not just me. There was one instance where I'd gone into urgent care for an ear infection, and I ended up getting talked to about my weight, and pretty much they dismissed me. And 2 days later, on vacation with my family, my grandmother took me to the ER, and I ended up having cellulitis in my ear, and I was on a morphine drip. So not being taken seriously is a major, I don't even know how to say, it's just, I want to be taken seriously no matter what my weight.
What are some of the things that your doctors blamed on your weight?
Like I said, ear infections, my knees, they sounded, when I had the issue, they sounded like pop rocks when I was walking down the stairs. I have had colds where in college I would go into the infirmary and they would say, well, do you think maybe you should lose a little weight? Do you think that might help? Are you kidding me?
Why do you think it was so pervasive that doctors would just bring this up whenever they saw you?
I think it's the whole war on obesity. I think that the whole war on obesity is a war on people. essentially. Like I said earlier, it's not weight that equals health. It's the whole BMI system, I think, is very outdated. I personally, I'm about 285, give or take, and I have done a marathon walking. I've tried to complete a Tough Ruck, which is 26.2 miles with 30 pounds on my back. I'm very active, but I'm obese.
So did you ever try to lose weight?
Absolutely. When I was a little bit younger than I am now, I ended up having an eating disorder of anorexia bulimia, trying to lose weight. We had a Biggest Loser competition at the office that I used to work at. And I'm a very competitive person, and I ended up eating very little and working out too much. And I ended up in therapy. Hmm. And I had to go through a lot of self-exploration, dealing with, you know what, if I'm going to be this weight, then I need to love my body.
Did you ever try to tell a doctor how it made you feel?
Yeah. My new doctor now that I see, his practice is fairly open to the idea of body positivity, but it took me a lot to get him there. At that time, I was reading a couple bloggers that are fat activists, and I thought, you know what, I should take my health into my own hands. And I ended up using one of the bloggers. They had a to-do list almost on how to go to your doctor and explain, not being confrontational, but explaining where I'm coming from in a way that they would understand. So I went to the doctor for a physical, and I said, listen, I was wondering if we could take 10 minutes just to talk about how I feel about this. I mentioned what Healthy at Every Size was, that being my weight and being active, that, you know, look at my blood pressure, you know, look at my blood work, you know, everything is positive. My cholesterol level is perfect. If the only thing that I have against me is my weight, I think I'm doing a pretty good job. And he was extremely receptive. But I would also mention it took me a long time to find this particular doctor. I've gone through a lot of different doctors, and finding the one that was just perfect for me was very hard. I mean, that took a few years.
You know what's funny listening to you is that I'm sure all of your doctors thought that they were just being helpful.
Yeah. Oh, no, I would agree. But they weren't putting themselves in my shoes. They were probably just thinking of the end game. Like, well, you know, she'll lose weight. You know, I'm going to keep on telling her to lose weight, and I'm going to not necessarily shove it down her throat, but, you know, maybe I can tell her, you could get these shakes and you can lose weight. Well, I didn't come in here for a lecture on, you know, why I should lose weight.
Is there a better way for them to express what they're trying to tell you?
I would say not being distant. I know it's very hard these days, especially that we don't have a lot of doctors, and doctors have a lot of patients to see every day, but taking a moment and becoming familiar with your patient, knowing that he's actually listening to me, that he's, you know, being friendly, I think that would help.
Do you still worry about your weight impacting your health?
In the long run, no. I think that being active in the way that I am, I'm certainly not going to change that. I just signed up for 3 5Ks, and I think I'm crazy. And I'm going to stay the way that I am.
Amanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Amanda Horahan is a payroll coordinator at Fresenius Medical Care, North America, in Waltham, Massachusetts.
My name is Arslan, and I'm calling from Chicago. I used to be overweight, and people would talk about me as if I was just another fat guy. But then I lost weight, and suddenly people started talking to me more and more, and my personality came in the limelight. I was Arslan, which is my name, not that fat guy anymore.
Hello, this is Victoria from Minneapolis. I lost 80 pounds 3 years ago and have kept it off. And I think it's more about how I've treated myself than how others treated me. It's better.
We want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to tell us your story. Tweet us. We're at The Takeaway, and we'll be exploring this topic all week. And if you're interested and live in the New York metro area, we encourage you to come and be an audience member in the WNYC Green Space for The Other F Word, The Politics of Being Fat in America. The event is being moderated by feminist writer Lindy West with guests Ashley Tipton, the winner of the Project Runway Season 14. It's going to be an open and honest conversation with lots of very interesting people about being overweight in America. Go to our website at thetakeaway.org to find tickets or look for us on Twitter. We'll have the link to the tickets page pinned to the top of our account. And that's all for us today. Thanks, as always, for listening and for being a part of this conversation. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom.com, helping Americans plan for their family's future with estate plans that include legal guidance provided through LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA believes smart financial decisions should enable life, not define it. TIAA calls this the new success story. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. And Staples. Staples offers copy and print solutions for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
This is Ira Flatto, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI, to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.